Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning and welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast, save them if you wish, and listen to them at your leisure. This show's all about science in all its different forms. Every Saturday morning between 11 and 12, you've got Julian Pauly live in the studio. Later in the show, we'll be talking to our PG for his bits and pieces this week. It's going to be including the supermoon as well. Our guest speaker this week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, is Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. He's going to be talking about developing your people photography. Now, what's interesting, I was looking in a gift guide in one of the newspapers, a big gift guide, and what I call traditional cameras are all the rage, from a child's camera by Hopstar to a kid's digital camera by Camcore, all in very nice colours. I've never seen so many. An Ilford 35mm film camera, which you can get off Amazon for £40. And if you've got loads of money, a Nikon limited edition ZFE camera with designs by Harold Bonnet. So amazing that things, traditional cameras are back up, because it's a trendy thing to have. Sony have also done a compact camera for vloggers with a 20mm lens, a 4000 Ultra HD, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth and touchscreen, and that costs a whopping £500 from johnlewis.com. Wow. Amazing. So how things change. Maybe the kids wanting not to use mobile phones anymore. Who knows? Our guest speaker next week, normally we have Chris Dale on the fourth Saturday of the month, talking about ultra-processed foods and the impact on our health of those things. But instead, we've got a very special guest. It's Tom Wenham. He's the Great Britain Olympic lacrosse coach. He's going to speak to us for an entire hour. He's going to talk about his lacrosse journey, but he's mainly going to talk about how sports science is used in preparing an elite team ready to compete at a world level for the gearing up towards the Olympics, the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics. All exciting stuff, eh? Next up, I'm just going to talk quickly about an article I saw in the press. Brilliant batteries An intercity battery train trial in the north of England has proven that the technology can outperform diesel engines for cost effectiveness. The trial conducted by Hitachi Rail, Angel Trains and TransPennine Express used a battery that matched the weight of a diesel engine and was installed in the same space on the train. If scaled up, this means that no new infrastructure such as overhead wires would need to be installed on existing non-electrified routes. All good news.
And yes, NHS drones. The NHS has deployed drones for the first time to deliver blood samples between London hospitals in 2 minutes rather than a 30-minute journey through the capital's congested streets. Following their launch on Tuesday, drone flights will hop between the rooftops of Guy's and St Thomas's hospitals, containing samples from patients at risk of bleeding disorders who are set to undergo surgery. These will be analysed and help to speed up decision-making on whether to go ahead with an operation.
Great. And before I do this week's environment update, which I'll be focusing on COP29, which is Conference of the Parties 29, just to say that on social media or on Twitter, or X as it's called now, I think it was put out that Tom Wenham, the GB Olympic lacrosse coach, was on this week, but it's not. It's next Saturday. So don't miss it. It'll be exciting stuff. And Christelle will be leading that interview as well. So next up, our environment update, I'm going to focus on climate of the parties. A United Nations climate conference in Azerbaijan. It's been running since Monday the 11th of November. It will continue until Friday the 22nd of November. So what's it all about? Because there's a lot about it in the press, so I've tried to keep to the facts rather than some of the other things that have been bandied about. Now, world temperatures arising because of human activity, and this is called climate change or global warming. Increasingly, it is referred to as our climate crisis or climate emergency. So what's all this conference of the parties then? COP, as it's shortened to. Parties refers to the countries that have ratified a treaty called the UNFCCC, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that document was signed back in 1992 by almost 200 countries. Now, Climate of the Conference of the Parties is the decision-making body linked to that agreement, and the representative of those countries meet every year to negotiate the best approaches to tackling the root causes of climate change. Now, there's another term that we hear a lot, but what does it mean? It's the term net zero, and it's often used when talking about climate change, and it basically means no longer adding to the total amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Now, the main way to do this is to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the first place, but not all emissions can be eliminated completely. So those that remain need to be actively removed. Now, greenhouse gases include carbon dioxide or CO2 gas and methane. Now, carbon dioxide or CO2 gas is released when oil, gas and coal are burned in homes, factories and to power transport. They are fossil fuels. Now, methane is produced through farming and landfill, as well as some other sources. Now, these gases, that's carbon dioxide and methane, increase global temperatures by trapping extra energy in the Earth's atmosphere. And at the same time as all that's going on, rapid deforestation across the world means there are fewer trees to absorb carbon dioxide. And this might sound pretty grim, and you might think, well, what can we do about it? And indeed, you know, major policy changes clearly need to come from the governments, businesses across the world. But every one of us can play their part to help reach net zero. These are just a few suggestions. Walk and cycle more if you can. Drive less. If you have to drive, try and drive a cleaner vehicle, ideally one that's not fueled by fossil fuels. Fly less, reduce your energy use, improve home insulation. Think before you buy something. Firstly, do you really need it? And then, is it from a sustainable source? Try and buy more energy efficient products, such as washing machines, when they need replacing. Don't go out and buy something new just for the sake of it, but just think about it when you buy something new. Eat less meat. Eat more locally grown seasonal fruits and vegetables. Now, ahead of Climate of the Parties 29, Which is now ongoing, the United Nations warned that progress on tackling climate change is in a worse position than a year ago after global carbon emissions jumped to a record high in 2023. And that Earth is on track for a catastrophic 2.8 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels. Now, pre-industrial levels means when we started burning fossil fuels to fuel industry and transport. So according to the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service, 2024 is virtually certain to be the warmest on record, with the average annual temperature predicted to be 1.55 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And if that isn't enough, furthermore, a report from the International Chamber of Commerce, or the ICC, indicates that climate-related extreme weather events have cost the world more than $2 trillion over the past decade. The research analysed 4,000 events between 2014 and 2023 that affected approximately 1.6 billion people, with $451 billion worth of damage occurring in the last 2 years. According to the ICC, that's the International Chamber of Commerce, the data from the past decade shows definitively that climate change is not a future problem and that major economic productivity losses from extreme weather events are being felt right now. An estimated 50,000 climate delegates are now gathered at Conference of the Parties 29, but interesting, leaders of the three biggest emitters, that's China, the United States and India, are absent, as is the president of the European Commission. The aim of Climate the Parties 29 is to secure an agreement for $1 trillion of funding to help developing countries transition to a green economy. But there again, the leaders of the world's biggest banks are also absent. Now, interestingly, earlier this week, the UK government announced fresh climate change targets at COP29 and called on other countries to follow suit. The UK will now aim for an 81% cut in its emissions by 2035, which is broadly in line with the UK's legally binding carbon cutting path towards net zero emissions by 2050, contained in the 2015 Paris Agreement.
Crying earth as we make sure I'm
Earth song there by Michael Jackson, 1995. We're playing that because we talked about climate of the parties, Conference of the Parties 29. That was the theme of our environment updates. You are, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. As I said, our guest speaker this week is not Tom Wenham. It's next week. So if you saw that on X, catch up with us next week. But we should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
How are you?
Yeah. So watch it. If my voice starts going croaky,
yeah, well,
I'm in trouble.
We'll turn you off, Paul. Yeah, you've not been too well these last few weeks, but there's a lot of stuff going around at the minute, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a weird thing, this. It sort of seems to come and go, but it gets around my larynx, so then I start doing funny voices.
Oh, brilliant. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Well, a bit of a mystery, I think, the first thing, is a great piece by Jonathan Amos on the BBC website, talking about somebody's moved the UK's oldest satellite and no one knows who or why.
Interesting.
So the satellite in question is called Skynet 1A. It was launched in November 1969. And it started out, basically just a couple of months after humans had first set foot on the moon. And it was to go into high orbit above Africa's east coast to relay communications for British forces. So it was launched on an American carrier, and it was controlled initially by America to put it into orbit. And it's in one of the high orbit positions at 22,369 miles above the Americas. So it's a half-ton spacecraft, and I say now it's a defunct spacecraft. But looking at what happened to it, sometime in the mid-70s, it was commanded to fire its thrusters, which took it westwards away from the position it used to be in. And it ended up in a kind of, well, they call it a gravity well, at 105 degrees west longitude. And it seems to be wandering around backwards and forwards like a marble, it's said, at the bottom of a bowl. And because it's dead, it might bump into something, or because it's our satellite, we're still responsible for it, in theory. So it's kind of a bit of a strange thing. You say that you can have all the conspiracy theories, and of course the name Skynet might have all the Terminator movie fans thinking that there's more to it than it appears. But it was actually manufactured in America by a company that's now defunct, Philco Ford, and put into space on a US Air Force Delta rocket. And it was a big revolution for communications for British forces at the time. And I'll say, originally the Americans controlled it and then eventually handed over control to the RAF. But basically, the Graham Davidson, who flew it in the 70s from the UK control centre, said, in essence, it was dual control. And when or why it was moved, it seems to have been handed back to the Americans, which seems likely, as a possibility, but I'm afraid he can't remember because he's now in his 80s. And I think Rachel Hill, a PhD student from University College London, has been scouring National Archives to try and find out some of the background. But obviously we've talked about recovery of things from space, so there are sort of things underway to try and recover these defunct satellites from the high orbits that they're in now rather than lower space. But the obvious danger with these things is if they do break up, they could become a terrible sort of danger to satellites at all sorts of altitudes. So a bit of a mystery. Nobody's quite sure how it did it, how it got to where it is. There might be some discussion between British and American governments about it, but our early sort of satellite adrift in space.
Yeah, well, this is only going to get more of an increasing problem, isn't it, Paul, as they put more and more things up there? And what do they do when they're defunct? How do you get them back?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as I say, it's kind of... You sort of think how much this thing would have cost, and we kind of just lost track of it. So it's said. So I thought that was a novel story, so interesting. It's on the BBC website if you want to go look for it. I think equally sort of looking back, we've not said anything, I think, for a while about Sheffield University. So there was something that I was going to bring up from, I think they released it on the 1st of November. And that's an engineering professor at University of Sheffield is going to be set up to develop the drive towards the 6G phone network.
Oh, my words.
So they say that the professor, Timothy O'Farrell, has been awarded a prestigious research chair to help develop this sixth generation of mobile networks, awarded from the Royal Academy of Engineering. And I think it just shows you the kind of things that are happening locally that could have a massive impact. So the University of Sheffield sort of contributing again, and I think in their news, the other sort of... thing that cropped up is they've done some research into a new system called agrivoltaics. That's not new, but this is a bit of new information from that. So it's a system that's been established in East Africa that combines solar power production with agriculture. And what they're saying is that this can help to boost crop yields, conserve water, and generate low-carbon electricity for areas which are particularly vulnerable to climate change, which in the last few weeks has become even more to the forefront, I think. And it's a new international study led by the University of Sheffield, and it's found that using the same land for both solar energy production and agriculture can generate low carbon electricity and improve crop yields and reduce water loss. And the illustration they've got shows a site where there are solar panels intermixed with fields of growing crops. And the solar panels generate energy but also shield some of the crops from the harshest sun. So it sort of works on lots of different grounds. So they're saying this is a great thing for the areas that are, it's led by scientists at the University of Sheffield and with the Centre for International Forestry Research and World Agroforestry.
Amazing. But aren't we lucky to have, you know, two world-class universities in Sheffield? They're both very well regarded.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're starting to see movements to try and unleash these things, because quite often what you find with the research, actually breaking it out into a commercial entity,
yes,
has been very difficult. So I see that, you know, the government at the moment is trying to put some foundation stones in to underpin development and to sort of cash in on some of the things that we're great at inventing things, great at testing them, but then really bad at scaling up to reap the benefits from it. So interesting couple of areas of research, and I thought it was very good. And I think also one of the things that I noticed, because the foul weather, I hadn't seen the moon much, but then I suddenly, on the last week or so, saw the moon was getting very bright and very prominent when it could break through. And of course, we just reported that, I think last night, was the Beaver supermoon.
Yes.
So it's the November full moon special, and again from BBC, but this time from CBBC.
Interesting
article from Newsround, and it says that it'll appear in the skies through the week, which it did. Say locally, I could see it quite well. Didn't seem like one of the earlier supermoons we had, but basically because the moon's doing an elliptical circuit around Earth, it changes its apparent size and brightness. So that was it. They were saying that they can appear up to 15% brighter and 30% bigger than a regular full moon. So I thought, that's interesting. But then a lot of people were reporting on it, and saw a lot on the news calling it the Beaver Moon. So, jokes aside, it was kind of like, well, yeah, okay. Well, so the full moon's got many different names throughout the year, and we've got 12 full moons a year, which have each got at least an informal nickname. So the Beaver Moon is called that because it occurs at a time of the year when animals, the beavers, start building their dams.
Wow.
So that was the thing. And this article runs through and explains a bit more about it. But it also gives you a rundown and says, what are the full moons and what do they mean? So January's full moon was the wolf moon. And we did talk about it at the time. And Native Americans and medieval Europeans called it, this full moon, a wolf moon, thought to be because the wolves howled more at this time of year because there was less food.
Amazing. Then, I never knew any of this, Paul. Fantastic.
I thought it's a great, great thing. February was called the snow moon because of the snowy weather starting in North America. They generally did it, but it's also got names like the storm moon and the hunger moon. March, this is a great one, is the worm moon. And the worm moon appears in March at the end of winter, when little creatures like worms begin to squirm out of the ground. It's also called the milk moon. Nice one for April is the pink moon. So it says, disappointingly, it isn't actually pink, but it's named by Native Americans after the pink flowers called wild ground phlox that bloom in early spring. So it's a time, and it's also called the egg moon and the fish moon in other cultures. In May, we get a flower moon, and that's mainly because the flowers are coming into season. But other names are the hare moon, the corn planting moon, and the milk moon. So, great stuff. June gets us a strawberry moon, which is when Native Americans harvested strawberries. It's also called the honeymoon, rose moon, and mead moon. July gets us a buck moon, and that's when the buck, a male deer, grows its full antlers. It's also called the thunder moon after summer thunderstorms. August gets us the sturgeon moon, which is when, again, North American people caught sturgeon, a type of fish. It's also known as a grain moon, green corn moon, or black cherries moon in some cultures. September gets us to a corn moon. So it's harvest time. Full moon, it's called the harvest moon instead. And October we get to a hunter's moon. So we did talk about the hunter's moon at the time. That's when people plan for winter months and hunt animals for food. And November is our beaver moon. and the December full moon will be a cold moon. And that's because winter time gets its name from that.
That was brilliant, Paul. You're going to do Phil Muffet out of a job. Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society, heat your heart out.
Well, I mean, I'm never going to complain. I can learn from CBBC as well.
Well, this is
that's
it,
why you're doing
it?
So well, Paul.
And am I right in thinking there is supposed to be 12 full moons? Is it 12? But there's 13 sometimes, and therefore that's when you get a blue moon. But I can't quite remember what that is.
That's it.
Once in a blue moon. Amazing stuff, Paul, as always. Now, I would say we'll speak to you next Saturday, but you've relinquished your spot because we're dedicating it to Tom Wenham, who's a great Britain lacrosse coach.
I won't get lacrosse about.
Very good, Paul. He'll be talking about coaching his athletes for the Olympics in 2020 Los Angeles.
Amazing. With interest,
sports science, it'll be fantastic. Great stuff, Paul.
I used to work alongside some sports scientists, so
excellent stuff. We'll speak to you Monday, Glory's Rock Show, 1 till 3. Bye-bye.
Yep.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye. I'm an alligator. I'm a mama, papa, calling for you. I'm a space invader. I'll be a rock and roller bitch for you. So keep your mouth shut. Church of mad love. That's such a holy place to be. But don't fake it, baby. Make me know you really care. Make me jump into the air. Keep your electric eye on me, babe. Put your right gun to my head. Press your space guns to my love. Be a cow in a moonlight night dream out. David Bowie there live with Moon Age Daydream. Great track, because RPG was talking about supermoons and indeed all the different names for all the moons. Who knew? I certainly didn't. The things you learn on the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every week from 11 till 12 noon. Next up, we've got our guest speaker for this week. It's Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine.
I can't believe a month has passed.
I know.
It might be more because you might have been... I can't remember now.
Yeah, I was away last month.
Time does fly. So this week we're going to be talking about developing your people photography. But before we talk about that, we visited the Sheffield Photographic Society Perspectives Exhibition in the Winter Gardens, and we thought it was absolutely brilliant, as it always is.
I actually think it was one of our best this year.
Yeah, it was. I would say there was more pictures. Yeah, I thought there was more.
We had more, and we had... I think the quality was up, and I think there were some really strong themes, and it just worked well.
Did you get a lot of feedback from...
We have had quite a bit of feedback, yeah. We've just... Because we leave a little booklet out for people to write in, and then obviously people... Over lunchtime, we have stewards there, and we get feedback directly. And we've had quite a big update on our Facebook page, which is quite nice.
Yeah, when we visited, there wasn't any stewards there, and there wasn't the book. And I was expecting to be able to vote for my favourite picture, but alas.
This is not the voting one. That's coming up in the cathedral in a few months.
Is it? Excellent. Yes. Let us know about that, and we'll pop in and see you. But I would say that every exhibition we've been to, generally you've done... A little bit of photographs of old Sheffield in black and white. I think, is it Ray Brightman? They are just so interesting.
Well, it's interesting because we've been working with Ray to put together some of the guys to try and put his collection together, because Ray is, he's been a photographer since the 50s. So he's really captured old Sheffield. Now they're on Picture Sheffield. And actually, I think last month, or they might even still be there, if you went on, you know what Picture Sheffield is up in there? Yeah, yeah. If you go on to the website, I think they were the front page pictures for quite a while, or a selection of them anyway. So we're now collecting as many of his, you know, prints as we can, digitising them and getting them onto Picture Sheffield so people can see them, you know, in perpetuity.
He's really captured for people, particularly if you grew up in Sheffield. It's just amazing how much it's changed, and he captured it, and
he was he's a good photographer as well, which helps, because it tells a story, every picture, and then when you see all of them together, and as you say, compare them to what it's like now, it's amazing.
Brilliant. So people photography then.
Yeah, so, I was going to tie this into the exhibition, actually, because I don't know if you noticed, but for the first time at the exhibition, we had a series of boards for one of our special interest groups. So the society set up various groups now that specialise in various bits and pieces. And the one that's been most active is the portrait group, which, coincidentally, I lead. And I'm the guy who organises that. So we had two boards of portrait photographs up there, which I think some of the, there was some really good work on there, some of the strongest images in the collection. And it got me thinking about people photography, because if you go back sort of 5 years or so, just before I became president, Sheffield was very strong in things like nature and landscape photography. And there were a few of us doing street photography and creative stuff. But we were very weak in portraiture and sport. And that meant when we came to doing things like the national competitions, we were always slightly hampered because we couldn't cover the whole range of topics. Or if we did, they weren't very good. So a few of us got together and we deliberately set out to have a program to improve people photography within the club. The problem is something called COVID came along.
Oh, yes.
And sort of blew us out of the water a little bit. But it did start me off on a kind of personal journey to improve my people photography. And what I thought I'd talk about a bit today is not so much the technical aspect, but kind of the social and psychological aspects of taking pictures of people. Because we all take pictures of family and friends and, you know, particularly with mobile phones these days, you're always taking pictures of people. But they tend to be very sort of instantaneous, but snappy. You don't really give a lot of thought to composition and, you know, the light and shade and all that stuff. So it got me into thinking about how could I improve my photography. And I did start taking pictures of my family and daughter, and then friends, but I was always very nervous about asking strangers if I could take their photograph.
Yes, in this world we live in, yeah, it's a different world now.
It is. I mean, I used to do, as you know, I've always done street photography, but I tended to do it in a way that people were incidental. So you'd be taking a street scene, there would be people in it, but it wouldn't be a close-up portrait of the individual, very rarely anyway. So you didn't have that same issue, but trying to improve things. So I started thinking about, well, you know, how do I tackle this? And about that time, the Kelham Victorian Christmas Market was on, which is on again in 2 weeks, by the way.
Oh, wow. But,
just funny how things tie in. It's obviously like we planned it.
I know. Well, it is. I know.
So I thought, well, I'll just take my camera, because I always do a couple of hours on duty at the museum, either selling tools or whatever we're doing, you know. But this time I took my camera and I started taking pictures of all the people dressed up in Victorian costumes. And, of course, the thing about people when they dress up in stuff like that is they want to have their picture taken.
Yes.
So they didn't mind at all. You almost didn't need to ask them. You know, if they saw you with a reasonable camera, they just posed, you know. And it was actually hard to stop them getting a bit carried away sometimes. But that started me off doing a lot more people. I did the, when we used to do it, I don't remember, we used to have a 40s weekend at the museum.
Yes.
I have to be careful what I say. It's gone by the board now for the reasons of political correctness. But, I mean, I used to love it, and I think a lot of people did. And, you know, again, people dressed up in all sorts of costumes, military costumes, but also just general 40s-type look. And that was another opportunity for me to start photographing things. So from there, I started searching out reenactment events so I could go to these and take pictures of people. Not so much the reenactment in the wide, but actually to start taking portraits of the individuals. And, you know, as I said, people love to be photographed at these events. So, I mean, I've been all over the place. I've been to a Peaky Blinders event in the museum in Birmingham. I've been to a steampunk event in a pumping station in Nottingham. I've been to a Second World War reenactment in an old airfield in Lincolnshire. And all of these places, you get the opportunity to photograph people who don't mind you pointing a camera at them and will actually give you the time to sort of set about and, you know, work out settings and your composition and practice things that way. So that kind of started me off into getting more into people photography. And as you probably know, I take more pictures of people these days than anything else.
Yes, I particularly like the black and white ones, but I do like black and white photography.
Yeah, and I think it works really well with certain models, particularly. I like to take, you know, craggy old guys with beards and wrinkly faces who look like they've lived a life. And if you put that into black and white, it kind of carries emotion and tells a story in a way that a colour picture may not.
Yeah.
And you can get into real detail. And also it simplifies the background. If you've got a really noisy, busy background, you turn it black and white and everything's much simpler. It's much more dynamic.
Yeah, interesting.
So from there, I've got into, I started doing a few photographic workshops. So you do find there are some reenactment groups that organise events just for photographers. So you don't have to fight with, you know, crowds of people trying to get, they are there just to be photographed. There's a group called the Ragged Victorians. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they kind of tour the country. They do shows for, you know, public shows as well. But every now and again, they'll do a day of just posing for photographers. And their costumes are very realistic. They're very authentic in the way they go about it. And it's great to sort of photograph them from that point.
Because they're putting the effort in as part of that event anyway. It's not, and it takes it all out of it, of asking people permission, doesn't it? Because there's certain rules in society now. For example, like when the Peace Gardens first opened, there was a big issue about, you know, children running through the fountains and people taking photographs of the Peace Gardens, or they're getting married in there.
Yeah.
And no, I mean, it's all, still, yeah.
I think I've told you before, we have a colleague in the society going to a real argument because he was in the Peace Gardens taking a picture of, actually, I think it was the flowers, the May blossom and the fountain, and there happened to be some kids playing, and one of the parents took real exception. And, you know, it got a bit out of hand, to be honest, but you do have to be careful, and that's the beauty of these things. The other thing is, of course, you can move people around to where the best light is. You can take artificial lights if you want. We've done that a few times, and it sort of works really well. That then led me into thinking, well, if I'm doing this, some of the reenactors were actually photographing models as well. So I started doing workshops where you may get four or five photographers with one model on location or even in a studio. And you have complete control then over the light, the poses, the composition. And that really helps you to develop, you know, how you photograph people. And that's led on to me now. I hire my own models. I use various studios. There's some really good studios in Sheffield. I mean, there's one at Portland Works, which is nice and big. There's another one in Chesterfield called Spire Studios. And there's one just behind the Wicker called Zavod, which is the one I use most.
Is there? I didn't know that. Where's that then?
It's on, so there's a place called, well, Joyner Street is just behind the Wicker. And it's an old industrial building. Wow. Half of it is a boxing gym and the other half is a photographic studio. And it's just great because you've got all the lighting set up you could ever want. It's a nice clean space. You can, you know, you can dress it however you want. It's got nice changing rooms for the model. You can have a cup of tea. It's just a really nice atmosphere. And not all that expensive. I mean, that's the other thing that people think you're going to have to pay hundreds and hundreds of pounds to hire models and studios. It's not. It's not that expensive.
I follow you on, obviously, Sheffield Photographic Society on Facebook, and I've noticed there's been quite a few posts where these specialist teams have put up their photographs of probably the same model or from a similar shoot, because you've all got different styles and techniques.
Yes. So what I've been doing, and it's really picked up this year, is organising shoots for probably up to, there's about 18, 20 people in this group now that does portraits. And we've done things from, so we did a walk around Kelham Island with a model, a Ukrainian lady who's based in Sheffield now. And she was great. And just, you know, we used the background of Kelham. You've got the old buildings, the new stuff. It was great. So you'll have seen lots of pictures of her. But also I've hired the studio Zavod for a few hours, and we've taken maybe six photographers from the group. Everybody checks in, you know, 20, 25 quid. And it means you can get studio and model for an evening for 20 quid.
Which is just fantastic.
Yeah, and that's why you'll see, you know, the same model appearing lots on our Facebook site. Yes. The interesting thing is, although it's six people with the same lights, the same model in the same space, the photographs are quite often very different.
Yes.
And that's about the approach to it and how you tackle the subject and all sorts of things. So we're continuing to do that. We do other things. We had a shoot at an old school, the old Prince Edward School up in Manitop.
Wow.
Which is, funny enough, that's also got a martial arts centre in there. But we use that to do kind of a zombie reenactment. And one of the models I know in Sheffield was happy to dress up as a zombie and wear all the makeup and that.
Amazing.
It was great fun. And then the other thing we've done recently is one of the members' daughter is studying ballet. So she came along and brought some of her frocks and posed in various ballet poses for us, which was great for practicing, you know, photographing movement and shapes and things like that. So that was another really good. I'm looking for things now. If anybody's got any ideas of people who want to be photographed, that's what we're trying to do, is a group of different ideas.
I tell you what, you ought to look around some music venues, you know, where rehearsal rooms in Sheffield's. Right, bands love to be photographed.
That's a good idea.
It is a good idea. Yeah. You know, maybe open mic nights, quite a lot of places like Alderbar around Kelham Island, if you know where that is.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
They're having lots of events on.
Yeah, I've done quite a lot of concert photography, but as an individual, and you have to be a bit careful. Some places don't like it.
I'm thinking about Kellermound in particular. You've got Alderbar, you've got Church, Temple of Fun. I mean, inside there, if you've ever been in, Gareth, it's phenomenal. Yes. You've got the stained glass windows. They have a lot of events. I'm sure people would love to have some proper photography.
That is a good idea. It is.
I'm sure people have got lots of other ideas. So I'm sure we saw that picture of the ballet, the girl in the ballet at the Perspectives exhibition.
There were two of the exhibition.
Yeah. So when's the next exhibition coming up? You've said it's the cathedral, but that's the
spring, March or April, I think. And we that's the competitive one. So that's the one we've just done. People just put whatever they like in. But this one, we all have to submit our photographs in January, and then we get an external judge, a professional judge, to come and pick out the best. 152.
You had a lot in last year. Well, was it early this year? You had quite a lot, I think. Did you have seven?
I'd had six, not this
six.
Year.
Six.
I'm quite pleased with, yeah.
Competition, eh? So, you know, for the one, the Perspectives exhibition, this has just been at the Winter Course, you do that annually. But is there a big fight for who can display what? Are you limited with the amount everybody...
It's limited to the number of boards where we can get in the Winter Gardens. I think something like, I think there are 50 boards in total, but they're different sizes. I don't know if you noticed, they're either a metre square or they're a metre by 60. Some of them are like half size.
Yes, but I certainly noticed it was a much bigger exhibition. And do you think people are actually more interested in photography and pictures?
I think we've had more feedback this year, and there's certainly more interest in the Facebook page than we've ever had. We have got, the season's well underway now, we've had quite a few visitors, and we've got a few new members of the club, but we've lost a few as well. I think that's the problem with camera clubs is often, people have been in them for years, and it gets to a point where they just stop coming. But numbers are, pretty good again. And there does seem to be a lot of interest. I'm trying to persuade the club to sort out its Instagram page at the moment.
Yeah. You see Instagram for photographs. That's the key. Yeah.
Yeah. We had one which was very active up until about 18 months ago, and then it sort of stopped because the guy who was doing it, I can't remember, he sort of disappeared for a while, but he's back now. We're trying to get it set up.
Oh, brilliant. I'll definitely follow that. And I noticed on Facebook you're advertising some events that are coming up, evening events. And although they are for your members, visitors can actually attend and pay a small fee.
Yeah, we're very happy to see people. Some of the things are a bit internalised, so you probably wouldn't want to come. But we've got some fantastic speakers coming who, if you've got an interest in, look at the particular aspects of photography that they do. We've got some great wildlife speakers this year. I think it's £3 or £4, I can't remember exactly. You get an evening's entertainment. If you really enjoy it and you go on to join the club, you get your money back anyway.
Brilliant.
So we'd love to see more people. We had a few visitors last week who... And it was a competition night last week, so they came and saw, 60-odd photographs from all over, different types, different places. A professional judge going through what was good and bad about them. So anybody who's got an interest in photography, just come along.
Wow, so. Brilliant. So, just follow your Facebook page, and I shall look forward to the Instagram page.
I shall let you know when it's up and running.
Brilliant. I think next month you're going to come and talk back to us about All Being Well Christmas gift ideas, as I said at the top of the show today, the amount of just saw in a gift guide in a magazine, as you often get around this time of year, every single page for every age range, there was some form of what I would call a traditional camera.
it's going very retro at the moment.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. And also, we'll give you a plug for Kelham Island Victorian Christmas Market. You said it starts in 2 weeks.
It does, November the 3rd.
And also, we can't come to this talk, but we know you're doing a talk on Wednesday the 4th of December as part of the Hawley, Ken Hawley tool collection at Kelham Island.
Yeah.
But I believe it's full.
It's
you're too popular.
It's we've had to put, and we've actually managed to squeeze another row of chairs in, but they went straight away as well. So
Well, I think they're coming ever more popular, aren't they?
Great
stuff.
I mean, we are trying to keep the collection sort of progressing because it's we don't get any money from anywhere else, so it's all volunteer driven. But
well, we went to the actual Ken Hall. We had before we went to a talk there from one of your colleagues. I think it was Nick. We went and had a quick look around the Hawley collection, and we thought it's much improved. There's so much more information.
We've done quite a bit to sort of bring it a bit more up to date. It was a bit static, so you know we've got the figure made out of
that's fantastic, brilliant.
You know, we're gonna have some other. We've got the new tool bank display. We'll hopefully have the year knife back in very soon. We're going to drop the security after some.
Brilliant. Great stuff, Gareth. Thanks for chatting to us today. Fascinating stuff. And we shall speak to you next month.
All right.
All right. Take care. Bye bye.
See you. Bye.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, when you're strange, all right, yeah. When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange.
Great track there by The Doors. Wow. People are strange. We played that because we're talking to Gareth Morgan from Sheffield Photographic Society about developing your people photography. All good stuff. We are fast coming to the end of this week's edition of the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We've got the film show in the house. Hey. Hey, can't wait to go. Before we go, just time to talk about an article that our friend Chris Dale sent. He'll be in the studio live next week with the GB lacrosse coach, Tom Wenham. The Garden, this article says, The Guardian says addiction to junk food is costing the UK £268 billion a year, according to the first ever research into the issue. The Food, Farming and Countryside Commission report warns the cost is becoming unpayable. The paper notes the figure outstrips the budget for the whole NHS. The report's called The False Economy of Big Food. Very quickly on that note, it's 50 years since McDonald's made its way to the UK. 4 million customers in the UK every day, about 40 a second. 1986, they introduced the Happy Meal, and the first drive-through opened. 1.4 million is the number of people McDonald's has employed in the UK since it first opened. Since 1974, 12.5 billion portions of fries sold, 1.9 billion Big Macs sold, and 1.8 billion cheeseburgers sold. 1982 was the McDonald's breakfast was introduced. Bye-bye.